Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to be talking about a couple new movies that are opening wide. We've got McFarland's USA, Hot Tub Time Machine 2, The Duff, and then Wild Tales, which is an Argentinian film that is now getting released in the U.S. in limited release. It's nominated for an Oscar, something to look out for. There's also going to be some news, including my 100% completely accurate Oscar predictions for Sunday night. There will be the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But before we get started with all that, this is how you can get a hold of me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thanks, Ron Burgundy. Let's jump right into the news. The first piece of news, which I find really kind of interesting because of how movies actually work nowadays, is about the huge hit 50 Shades of Grey, which we talked about last week, and some of the fallout that's happening from the film. Normally, the way movies work now is they will oftentimes green light several movies at once or green light a sequel before the movie even is released. This is different from what it used to be 30 years ago when they'd make a movie, see how well it did, and then finally decide whether or not to do a sequel. That's why sometimes you had several years between movies. Ever since the Lord of the Rings shot the three movies concurrently and they started shooting back-to-back Matrix sequels and they were making the Harry Potter movies and they contracted people out for seven, and which turned into eight films. Movies now are in a pipeline, and it is pretty common for sequels to be released either planned already and already have release dates just on the chopping block or a franchise. And I would have expected that to happen with 50 Shades of Grey. You don't get the first book and make it into a movie and see what happens. This is the kind of thing you want to capitalize on. In movies like this, you want to release one every year. You want it to come out every Valentine's Day. Well, apparently there's still some wrangling going on with the 50 Shades sequels. And E.L. James, the woman who wrote them, wants more control over what happened with the movie. She fought with the director and she had a different vision. And I think they changed some things. So not only are there rumors of replacing the director, but there's also rumors of replacing Jamie Dornan as Christian Grey, which is a bizarre thing to do. Imagine if the Twilight movies had replaced Bella between the first and second movie or the second and third movie. As bad as Kristen Stewart was, it wouldn't have made a cohesive series. It would have felt weird to suddenly have a different actor. I mean, it was bad enough having they replaced the character Richard Lefevre with Bryce Dallas Howard in one of the roles, and that caused ripples through the fan community. I mean, as bad as Jamie Dornan was, can you replace him? I mean, you're not going to get Matt Bomer. You're not going to get Charlie Hunnam. These people already said no. There's also an issue with her wanting to write the sequel scripts because the screenwriter's not going to be coming back. Well, the reality is Universal's going to do whatever they want to. And this shows sort of a bear trap of when you involve the writer too much. Now, I'm a writer and I've written stuff and I understand the plight of the writer, but the writer's involvement ends when he or she sells the rights to the book. Even J.K. Rowling had only so much to say in what happens with the movies for the Harry Potter stories. She was in charge of the books and that's it. So this could be an epic disaster in the making. If this thing's not even ready to go now, and it had such a bad cinema score, I mean, the audience ratings were bad for 50 Shades of Grey, this could completely fizzle. And if they don't capitalize and do it right, or at least do it marketable, it could be a big problem. So we'll see what happens and see if they get the stuff straightened out. Another piece of news I want to hit on is Neil Blomkamp, who's best known for directing District 9. Now, he's directed Elysium, which wasn't very good, and he directed Chappie, which comes out next month. He's made more news recently because he released a whole bunch of concept art that he wanted to do for an Alien sequel, for the Alien franchise. And apparently by doing that, that generated enough interest that Fox is now actually going to let him do an Alien movie, which I think is cool. I think it's neat to revive that franchise from the ending side to see what happens. The franchise itself has some real rough patches, especially if you throw in the Alien vs. Predator sequel and then you throw in Alien 3 and 4. It's not a consistently good series. But I think it might be neat to revive that. I'm all for new Alien movies. And Neil Blomkamp, he could be good. Although he really only has one good movie so far. I don't know what Chappie's like. But District 9 was good. Elysium, not so much. Couple other news real quickly in development. Shaft is getting a reboot. And I hope that they make the bold choice of casting Jim Gaffigan as the title character. Pirates of the Caribbean 5 has started production with Johnny Depp, of course, in the lead role. You're going to see Javier Bardem as a bad guy. And you're going to get Jeffrey Rush returning. I'm curious to see what happens with this one. Because once it got out of Gore Verbinski's hand, I think it actually turned up a little bit for the franchise. And then finally, latest news on the Friday the 13th film that's coming up, which is the 13th in the series, which I think needs to have a certain amount of care done to it, because the 13th of Friday the 13th, now it is being said that it's not going to be found footage, for sure. Not found footage. It should be filming this year, and I think it opens next summer. It has a weird summer release date, which usually isn't good for Friday the 13th movies. You want to drop those in, like, the fall or the winter, but it's going to come out in the summer because that's probably one of the days that actually has Friday the 13th as the date. Time to move on. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's look at what's coming up in theaters soon. We've got The Water Diviner, which stars Russell Crowe. And this was an Australian film from last year. Got a whole bunch of nominations for the Australian Academy Awards, including Best Picture, I believe. And it's the story of a man trying to find his sons who have gone missing or presumed dead after a war.
My boys, Arthur, Henry, and Edward Connor.
We're not leaving your brothers behind.
All enlisted together. And they died together. They should be buried at home beside their mother. I'll find them, love.
It looks like it's well made. It reminds me a little bit of Unbroken. Feels like it's the very deliberate attempt to do an award film, getting some nominations, getting some notice. And as interesting and as touching as the subject is, it looks almost a little overdone. It could be good. It could be a real tearjerker. It just has a really rough trailer. And speaking of slightly rough trailers, we've got Crimson Peak, which opens on October 16th. This one is Guillermo del Toro's next film.
Has anyone died in this house? Specific deaths. Violent deaths.
I'm here to take you away.
There's nowhere else to go. This is your home now.
Beware of Crimson Peak.
This looks cool. I'm all for haunted house movies. It looks like it's almost as cross between The Woman in Black and Pan's Labyrinth. Guillermo del Toro is a very talented guy. I don't particularly like all of his films. Some of them I like, some of them I'm sort of lukewarm on. But I cannot discount the guy's passion. And it looks like he really throws a lot of his passion to this, and it looks very gothic, and it looks very del Toro. The biggest thing that has me worried, and you can see this because obviously it's radio, so you heard the trailer. It says in the trailer as a title card, it says, from the imagination of Guillermo del Toro comes his ultimate masterpiece. I am a little nervous when a trailer declares a movie to be the ultimate masterpiece of anybody, because that's marketing. To call it an ultimate masterpiece, that's something to be decided later on. I mean, when you looked at 2001 from Stanley Kubrick, they weren't saying it's his ultimate masterpiece until later on people looked at it and said that was maybe the pinnacle of his film directing. it's hard to say what your masterpiece is going to be. That's left for the historians to decide, not the marketeers. That's the biggest thing that worries me. Otherwise, it looks like it's a neat little creepy gothic story, and I look forward to it. And it's opening in October, which is a great time for horror movies. All right, with that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about McFarland, USA and Wild Tales. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming back at you with Bat Guys at the Movies. Let's roll into the new movies we've got this weekend. The first one is an inspirational Disney sports movie, which is kind of turned into its own formula. I'm not a sports guy. I've never been a big sports fan. And growing up in Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio in particular, that's kind of a tough road to go down because you've got OSU, you've got the Browns and the Bengals, you've got the Indians and the Reds. You've got a lot of sports history in Ohio. And I'm not a big sports fan. This is not about football or basketball or baseball. It is about cross country. In 1987, a troubled football coach starts a cross country team at an impoverished California high school and leads the kids to victory.
I'm Coach White, your new PE teacher. All right, run a lap.
Wow. They're fast.
They are. You know how fast you were going?
What are you, a cop?
I want to start a cross-country team.
That's a private school sport.
We have kids here who seem like they can run forever. And they pick an extreme heat. They go to school all day. Some of them even run home. I've seen it.
Jim, let me ask you something. You've coached cross-country before?
No.
Well, you sound perfect.
Like I said, I'm not a big sports fan, but I do like a good inspirational sports movie. Now, there's some that are crap. And there's some that people like that I don't particularly like. Like Friday Night Lights. I just did not like that movie. I thought it was poorly done. And I thought it focused on the wrong things. And even the Disney inspirational sports movies, there are films like Glory Road, which was the one with Josh Lucas as a basketball coach integrating the basketball team with black players, which is, it just sounds so ludicrous now when you sit there with, well, black people can't play basketball. Who nowadays, when you look back and sort of historically, who nowadays, what coach is going to say, no, we only need white kids on this team? It seems like such a ridiculous concept. And they actually make fun of it in movie 43. But I wasn't a huge fan of Glory Road. I thought that it tried to juggle it a little too much. McFarland, USA follows a very typical formula for these inspirational sports movies. And especially recently, you know, like last year we had Million Dollar Arm, which wasn't a bad little movie. And it was an inspirational sports movie from Disney about John Hamm going across the ocean to India to try and find the next great baseball player. This one, of course, is based on a true story. And Kevin Costner plays the coach. And what's interesting is in 1987, I actually did run cross country. I know you look at pictures of me now and you think that Tubelard ran cross country. I did for like a season and I quit that nonsense very fast. I am not a runner. I hate running. It's like the most horrible thing. I have friends that are runners. And particularly in high school, I knew a couple guys and they just could run. They could just run and run and run. And it's just how you're built. Even when I was in the best of shape of my life, I was not a runner. I wasn't a sprinter. I couldn't do cross country. It was exhausting. But there are some people who it just comes naturally to them. So it was interesting watching this movie because knowing that I actually competed in high school at that time. I mean, I was in Ohio. I wasn't in California. And so I had no contact with the kids in this movie. But there was a certain realism there. And one of the things, and from an artistic standpoint, the movie looks like it was shot in the 80s. It really feels like a period piece. But it pushes all the right buttons, and it has its ups and downs, and Kevin Costner does a really good job as a coach. I mean, we've seen him playing these kind of roles before. I mean, we've seen him in the baseball movies, Field of Dreams. We've seen him in the football movies. You know, he was in Draft Day last year. Kevin Costner clearly enjoys sports, almost as much as he probably enjoys Westerns. But the role's really well built for Costner. And it's kind of a shame because Costner has tried to make a comeback. He did movies like Draft Day last year, and he did Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit, and he was in 3 Days to Kill, and he just did Black or White. I mean, he's released like 5 or 6 movies in the last year or 14 months, and none of them have really clicked for anybody. And that's kind of a shame because he was once the greats in Hollywood. And he's also tried, I mean, he hasn't made a Western recently. I mean, he did the Hatfields and McCoys on TV, but he hasn't made a Western in a while for the movie theater. Maybe that's the next step because his sports movies are having a little bit of trouble gaining traction. This movie works, and it you know, it has all the characters. It has him bringing them out to inspire the kids and learning more about them. It's not as racially charged as, say, Black or White was, which that overdid it on the racial thing. This is a perfectly well done movie. And you may think, well, Cross Country? How boring is that? Well, it's not lickety split exciting. I mean, this is not Remember the Titans, but it works. You'd be surprised at how interesting and dynamic they make Cross Country. And it is very much about the team and about the change that takes place in the character. So, you know, I got to say, even though I'm not a fan of sports, not a fan of Cross Country, I've run it and it's awful. I got to say this movie worked, and it's an emotional movie, and it pushes all the right buttons very deliberately, but it does a very good job doing that. So I'm going to say that McFarland USA kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Wild Tales. I do not have a trailer for it, and that is because it's in Spanish. So it's either going to be just music or you're going to hear people talking in Spanish. And generally, if I start playing Spanish stuff on the radio, sometimes people will question me because they don't know what it says. Not everybody speaks Spanish. You can pretty much assure that anybody working in radio in America speaks English. But they don't speak Spanish, and then I'll get questions. What, are they saying anything offensive? So you're just not going to get the trailer. Sorry. Anyways, Wild Tales is an anthology of stories from Argentina, and it examines the darker and sometimes very humorous side of humanity. It's several stories linked together and all have to deal with some grim element of either death or violence. And it's nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Like I said, from Argentina. I mean, it's going up against some bigger names. It's going up against Ida from Poland and Leviathan from Russia, Timbuktu from Mauritania, and Tangerines from Estonia. So there's a wide range of films that it's going up against. And it's actually my favorite of the foreign films that I've seen. I haven't seen all of them. And the reason is because it's entirely transcendent from its culture. It's not about the plight of being Argentinian or whereas like Ida's about the culture, this girl who was raised in a convent is trying to find her family roots amid the sort of the aftermath of war. So there's a lot of cultural references, whereas this one's a little more universal, and it's dark, and it's sometimes extremely humorous. There are some very funny moments to it, and it's one of those movies that if you have a chance to seek it out, and don't let the subtitles intimidate you. So many people get intimidated by subtitles because they don't want to read, and yes, they got subtitles, and yeah, you got to read through this, but it's not like My Dinner with Andre with subtitles. You're not just reading constantly. It's a very dynamically shot movie. It's got a little bit of action. It's got a lot of comedy. It's got a lot of very tongue-in-cheek, sardonic, very biting humor. Dealing with families and revenge and crime. And honestly, I was sold on this from the opening story. The opening story takes place on a plane, and all these people suddenly find out that they all know the same person. And it seems almost ridiculous when it starts, but then as it starts filling itself out, you're realizing this becomes very scary. What's neat about it is it's basically a series of short films. And short films are great because if you don't like one, the next one's going to start pretty soon. So even if there's one of these stories that you don't like as well as the others, you've got several other stories to balance it out. So Wild Tales is an impressive film. I hope it wins the Oscar, which it won't. And I have to say Wild Tales totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about the other new releases, the Hot Tub Time Machine 2 and The Duff. Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're going to be talking about the other two movies that are coming out. I actually had to go see this as a double feature because it wasn't screened. So I had to go check it out on Thursday night. And it's the weirdest double feature you're going to see. It's so indicative of the fact that it's Oscar weekend, because Oscar weekend rarely has anything big, significant, or of huge quality and award consideration worthiness releasing in the main theaters. And it's always genre flicks or specifically set for a very specific audience. And that's what it was. The first one I want to talk about is Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Of course, is a sequel to the movie about guys who find a hot tub that is also a time machine. Very self-explanatory. Three of the four guys who took the original trip in the Hot Tub Time Machine take another trip, this time to the future, to stop one of them from being murdered.
It must be some kind of hot tub time machine.
Was it morally wrong to exploit our knowledge of the future for personal financial gain?
Ready for another dip?
I think this time maybe I'll invent yoga pants.
How far back do we go? 2025.
We need to find the point in time where things went wrong and fix it.
Here we go! So far, so good.
Back in the tub!
I was not an immediate fan of Hot Tub Time Machine. I knew people who thought it was genius from the title. And it is a brilliant title because it's so self-explanatory and it's so absurd. I love absurd humor and absurd movies. What also worked with the original Hot Tub Time Machine, and it finally grew on me after seeing the trailer and then seeing the film, what really got me was all the 80s references and the fact that it was sort of taking off of Back to the Future. You know, it had Crispin Glover in there. So there was a lot of meta references to it. And it was a very smartly written film. Yeah, it was raunchy. Yeah, it was dirty. But Hot Tub Time Machine, the original, really did some neat stuff. And what made it work was you actually kind of liked the characters and you wanted to see him prevail and you wanted to see him win. And even though some of them were better than others, and you know, he had Rob Corddry's character was the jerk and he was always sort of anchored as a jerk. John Cusack was sort of like the heart and soul of the group. The sequel, not so much. In fact, the sequel reminds me of a couple years ago, I got a DVD from a studio from Fox. And it was Bachelor Party 2, and it starred, instead of Tom Hanks, it starred Harlan Williams. Nothing against Harlan Williams. I think he's a very funny guy. But he's not exactly Tom Hanks. It was so typically just a crappy direct-to-video sequel. Same thing with, like, all of the American Pie movies. Once they worked their way through the theaters with American Pie 1, 2, and then American Wedding, and then they had American Reunion later on, but all those, like, Beta House American Pie movies that just went to video, Van Wilder sequels going straight to video. That's what Hot Tub Time Machine 2 reminds me of. It is vacant on plot. The characters are terrible because John Cusack wouldn't come back. And maybe he was a smart one here. Because then you're left with all these somewhat sidekick characters. The kind of the main character is Rob Corddry's character. And he's a jerk in the original movie. And this one, he's a jerk as well. And yeah, Craig Robinson is funny, but he just, unless he needs a straight man to be playing off of, or he's got to be the straight man, but he can't just be up against Rob Corddry. And they bring in Adam Scott to kind of replace John Cusack. He's not the same. It doesn't click. Plus, it's a stretch of a story. It really, really, it plays great. The trailer's fantastic. And I hate to be one of the cliche people who say all the funniest parts were in the trailer. And they kind of were. And then when you see them in the movie, like there's a whole thing, like you look like so-and-so. They look at themselves in the mirror and they're seeing what they look like now because they go in the future. And they're saying, you look like Gandalf the Poor. You look like a character in a Tyler Perry movie. You look like a cue ball. They just run that joke into the ground. There's the theory of comedy that if you do a joke once and it's funny, you can do it again and it might be funny. And then you keep doing it, it's no longer funny. And you do it long enough over and over again, it'll become funny again. They never get to the point of it becoming funny again. They barely were funny the first time. And it's drawn out. And it's overdone. And it's raunchy, but it's like mean-spirited. It kind of reminds me of a little bit of Dumb and Dumber 2, where there was a certain charm and innocence to the original movie that is lost and just becomes mean-spirited in the sequel. And that's kind of what Hot Tub Time Machine 2 is. It just doesn't work. It feels desperate and sad and pathetic. And you really can't get behind any of the characters. not even in a raunchy, goofy comedy sort of way. You got to have some sort of heart there, and it's just not there. So I got to say, Hot Tub Time Machine 2, sadly, I was looking forward to it, but man, it sucks.
It sucks.
All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Duff. This is not about the beer from The Simpsons. In The Duff, a high school girl faces bullying and relationship issues after discovering her friends might only keep her around to make them look better.
Here's my favorite Duff.
What?
D-U-F-F, designated ugly fat friend. It's not like a big deal. Every group of friends has one. You're the one who's approachable. You friended up. Good for you.
People like you will never matter.
Forget her. Prove her wrong.
I don't want to be anybody's Duff. Help me with this.
On one condition. You gotta ask me in your monster voice.
From when we were little?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it.
Okay.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm somebody's Duff. So is everybody. But it shouldn't affect how you see yourself.
When you boil it down, The Duff is really basically a Mean Girls kind of movie or Can't Buy Me Love kind of movie. One of these high school social strata movies like Jawbreaker or Heathers. Heathers is a work of genius. And part of the reason it's a work of genius is it satirizes high school at the same time satirizing sort of the John Hughes movie. And it does it in a very smart and hyper-real way. And so many movies try to do that, but they also try and be sincere. That's part of the problem with Heathers. Heathers isn't sincere. It's not a sincere movie. Whereas, like, Can't Buy Me Love is a sincere movie. It's a sincere little love story. And Mean Girls is a sincere movie. It's a comedy. But, you know, like Jawbreaker, they tried to do that with Jawbreaker, and Jawbreaker doesn't quite work because it doesn't get the satire right. And really, The Duff is the story of this girl, and it's her journey. And it's not just about her being Duff. Well, Duff means, you know, designated ugly fat friend. And kind of the point of it is everybody has been a Duff at some point in their life. Everybody has been friends with somebody who they make look better. And I've been there. I'm thinking of running myself out to high school girls and say, I'll be your Duff. I'll show up. Hey, what's up, babe? You know, I'm sure that will go over well. I'm sure I will not be arrested whatsoever if I try that. What really makes this movie work is Mae Whitman, who plays the Duff. And she's like 26, but she's young and she looks very youthful. She's cute. I always remember her because she played the daughter. She played Bill Pullman's daughter in Independence Day. But now she's grown up. And she's cute, but she's not gorgeous. But she is a very funny girl, woman. And she is extremely game in the role. She does some brave things in there. And she also is just very charming in it. And you really feel for her. And she is what makes this movie work. And the chemistry between her and her co-star, the good-looking boy who kind of helps her, sort of coach her out of being the Duff, they really work. But it's her. She holds the movie together. And there are some genuinely clever lines, and there are some genuinely funny moments. And I actually saw it, like I said, I saw it in a regular just public showing, and it wasn't packed, but it was pretty filled with teenage girls. And it was almost more entertaining watching it in that room because of their reaction, because it's made for teenage girls. It's like, I mean, really, if you're, you know, 48-year-old man, you may not be dying to see this movie, but teenage girls are going to love it. But I think anybody else who has to take a teenage girl or a tween girl to see the movie, you can enjoy it too. It has some stuff that you'll remember from high school. You'll sigh that you don't have to deal with it anymore. But it's just a cute little movie. It really clicks and it works. And I was surprised because I wasn't quite sold on the trailers, but it works. And even though it's an old message that we've seen many times before, and while the characters can be a little bit heavy-handed, like the villain Bella Thorne plays the mean girl, it's a little heavy-handed with her, but it's still very funny. And I enjoyed it. So I got to say, The Duff kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about my 100% accurate and infallible Oscar predictions, the box office, and the world-famous DVD roundup.
$5
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming back at you with the final lap of Fat Guys at the Movies. See that cross-country reference I'm talking about? The fat guy was once on the cross-country team. Gotta remember that. Before we go, I've got a couple things we gotta talk about. It's Oscar weekend. Neil Patrick Harris trying to outdo Ellen from last year. Those are big shoes to fill. That's tough. I mean, I do not envy Neil Patrick Harris. I think he can totally do it. I think he's got what it takes. He's got sort of the live performance, the Broadway show experience that I think he can do. You got to have a certain amount of theatrical charm, which is why Hugh Jackman was always a good host, and Billy Crystal. I hope Neil Patrick Harris does a good job. But let's talk about my predictions. I'm going to do what I refer to as the Big Six, which is the actor and actress and the supporting roles. And lead roles, and then also Best Director and Best Picture. Let's start with Best Supporting Actress. There's always great performances all around, even if I don't particularly like the movie. Like Laura Dern in Wild, I thought she did fine. And good for her that she got a nomination off of that. Traditionally, the Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress categories are a little bit challenging because there aren't a ton of great roles out there for women, and that's well known for Hollywood. It's a very male-centric business, so it's sometimes hard getting really good, solid roles. Now, one of the roles that I think is what's going to walk away with it, because you've got Laura Dern for Wild and Keira Knightley for The Imitation Game, and she was great, Emma Stone for Birdman, and Meryl Streep, who was great in Into the Woods, but I really think Patricia Arquette is going to win the Best Supporting Actress role, mainly because she's won it on a bunch of other awards. And she does a good job. I did not particularly like Boyhood, but I really think that she's primed to be the winner of that one. Now, in terms of Best Supporting Actor, Robert Duvall for The Judge, Ethan Hawke for Boyhood, Edward Norton for Birdman, Mark Ruffalo for Foxcatcher, and J.K. Simmons for Whiplash. I think it's interesting that we got two Hulks in there. You've got Edward Norton and Mark Ruffalo, both in the same category. Both of them have played The Incredible Hulk. Everybody did a good job. Again, not a big fan of Boyhood, but I think it's J.K. Simmons who's going to win for Whiplash. This is a movie that kind of came out of nowhere and suddenly got a bunch of award nominations, and he is getting tons of awards for Best Supporting Actor. Very deserving. And while these other four men do a great job, J.K. Simmons, he's the one to beat. He's the Jared Leto of this year. For Best Actress, Kieran Coutier for 2 Days, 1 Night. I wasn't a big fan of that movie. Felicity Jones, I think, is adorable. I love Felicity Jones. She was great in The Theory of Everything. I don't think she's going to win, though. I don't think Rosamund Pike's going to win for Gone Girl, even though she was great in that. Reese Witherspoon for Wild, I could take or leave. It was just such an Oscar grab for me. It just didn't work. Julianne Moore, though, for Still Alice. We talked about that last week. She does a fantastic job in the role, and it's heartbreaking and touching. And tender, this is the one to beat for Best Lead Actress. Now, for Best Actor in a leading role, you've got, of course, Steve Carell for Foxcatcher, which is kind of surprising because I didn't think that was a lead role, but I guess they're giving it to him. Bradley Cooper for American Sniper, he's great, but I don't think he's going to win for this one. Benedict Cumberbatch for The Imitation Game, he's got a chance. So does Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything, but really I think Michael Keaton for Birdman. This is his comeback role. This is his role that everybody is talking about, and it's giving him street cred, and Birdman has been gaining a lot of momentum over the last couple months. Which leads me to talk about directing and Best Picture. Let's talk about those together. Because there's a couple of them. I loved The Grand Budapest Hotel, and I loved The Imitation Game. I think one of those should win for Best Picture, Best Director. And Clint Eastwood did not get nominated for American Sniper. And this controversy and the politics behind American Sniper, I think, are going to cause that to not win for Best Picture. Selma, again, you don't have a directing nomination for that.
And Whiplash, once again, no directing nomination. I think it's really up for this one. It's got Birdman and Boyhood. Those are the ones that are going neck and neck. Those are the ones that the wind could blow one way or the other. And there's really not a runaway title. There's not a movie that's winning everything. Each one wins something. So I think you're going to see this get split. Even though the directors are both nominated in each category, I really think that Richard Linklater is going to win for Best Director for Boyhood because the Academy wants to give it to him. But I think Birdman is going to win for Best Picture. I think you're going to see a split this year. I like to predict the split. I think it's an interesting one to predict. And it hasn't happened since Argo, but that's because Ben Affleck wasn't nominated for Best Director. So those are my 100% accurate and infallible Oscar predictions. Write them down and see if I am right on Sunday night. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Valentine's Day weekend. Now, of course, no big surprise. 50 Shades of Grey won both the three-day weekend. For the three-day weekend, let's just talk about it without the President's Day in there. It was $85 million. I said $75 million. I was relatively close. But $85 million is a massive number for a February release. What breaking records. It's in fact one of the highest opening weekends for an R-rated release. But I think it's behind like Passion of the Christ, American Sniper. It's behind American Sniper, Passion of the Christ, and one of The Matrix Reloaded. And in the four-day, it made a whopping $93 million, because you got to include President's Day, which was Monday. And then in second place, not much of a slouch at all, was Kingsman, The Secret Service, $41 million for the four-day and $36 million for the three-day. Not a bad show for that one. I mean, it was dwarfed by 50 Shades of Grey, but that was still a great number. And you got to realize the top two movies, those were both R-rated movies. That's kind of impressive. That leads me to the question of who's going to win this weekend. I think it's pretty clear 50 Shades of Grey is going to win again. It got a pretty low cinema score, which measures how much the audience liked it. And those scores tend to skew a little high because nobody goes to see 50 Shades of Grey unless they're interested in it. You know, it's not representative of the entire population. It's just representative of the people who are going to buy a ticket to that movie. And so it actually had a low. It was like a B or a C cinema score, which is really low, actually. Usually it needs to be like an A. Most of them have an A, maybe a B+. But this one had a pretty low cinema score, which you're going to expect it to drop pretty fast. But even if it drops 60%, it's still going to make like $35 million this weekend. And I don't think Hot Tub Time Machine 2 is going to stand a chance of being in. I think McFarland USA is as good of a movie as it is. I don't think it has the wide appeal simply because it's attached to cross country and not like football. And then The Duff, I think, is going to be very, very popular among teenagers and like the female demographic at a sort of like the prime age of teen and 20s. But I don't think it's going to be seen by many people outside of that, simply because it doesn't appeal to them as a segment of the population. So I think 50 Shades of Grey is going to win again with $35 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies, and that sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. Of course, leading off the DVD releases, we have Birdman, as we've talked about, probably going to win the Oscar. At least that's my pick. And it'll probably win Michael Keaton Best Actor. It's worth seeing. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's now on DVD and Blu-ray, so, you know, give it some love. There's also The Interview, which has been, of course, available on demand since Christmas, and it was recently dropped onto Netflix. It is now available on physical media, DVD and Blu-ray, if you haven't had a chance to see it. The Theory of Everything, also a nice award movie that got a bunch of nominations. Definitely worth checking out if you have not seen it. Wonderful performances by Felicity Jones and Eddie Redmayne. One of my favorite movies of the year. Also, St. Vincent, another one of my favorite movies of the year, which got kind of snubbed at the Oscars. This one stars Bill Murray and Melissa McCarthy, Naomi Watts. And it's a very tender, sweet story that's also very, at times, darkly humorous. Definitely worth checking out. Life Itself is available. That is the documentary about Roger Ebert's life and ultimately his death. There's Dumb and Dumber 2, which is not very good. Not necessarily worth seeing. Doesn't hold up as much as the original does. The Holmesman, which was kind of a forgotten movie with Tommy Lee Jones playing a claims jumper. And he's helping a woman transfer some mentally disturbed women from one city to another in the Old West. VHS Viral, which was the latest installment in the VHS found footage series. One of the few found footage movies that I actually enjoy, although there's one segment in there that's awful. The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which was nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film, so we'll see how well that does on Sunday. Definitely worth checking out. Studio Ghibli, but not it's not Hayao Miyazaki. Still has the wonderful touch and the artistic touch of Studio Ghibli. Oh, there's also Phantom of the Opera, 1989, the Freddy Krueger version, the one with Robert Englund playing the Phantom of the Opera. It's actually not a bad Phantom of the Opera movie. It's just I think people were expecting Freddy Krueger and they didn't get him. It's worth checking out if you haven't seen it. It's not a bad little horror movie. And then from TV, you've got Game of Thrones Season 4, because you've got Season 5 coming up. And then Doctor Who Last Christmas, where Doctor Who teams up with Santa Claus. The stinker of the week is Dying of the Light. It's a Nicolas Cage movie, and he's still trying to pay off some debts by making about 15 movies a year. Next week, we're going to be talking about Focus and the Lazarus Effect. Be sure to watch the Oscars this weekend, see if my 100% accurate and infallible predictions are correct. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.